I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, quick, name the top security threat to the United States. If you guessed terror attacks caused by extremist groups, you are mistaken, at least in the eyes of the federal government, which is much more concerned with cyber attacks by other nations. The U.S. is deep into a cyber arms race with China, Russia, and other powers contributing to daily cyber attacks around the world. We'll talk about how 21st century battles are being increasingly fought electronically with New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger, who writes about the topic in his new book, The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. Our conversation starts after this short break. The embarrassing hack into a Hollywood studio by North Koreans, a takedown of the computers running much of Britain's healthcare system, and the cascade of events that followed the theft of emails from the Democratic National Committee before the 2016 elections, all are examples of the escalation of cyber attacks happening daily around the world, a reality that wasn't even on the list of top threats the U.S. faced just 10 years ago. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. Cyber weapons are cheap to acquire, and they are devastatingly effective. Russia, North Korea, China, Iran have used hacking to great effect. And my guest today argues they represent the biggest transformation in geopolitics in the last 70 years, a transformation that is largely invisible to the public. David Sanger is national security correspondent for the New York Times. His new book is called The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. David, welcome to Think.
Great to be with you, Kim.
So it may come as a surprise to some people that terrorism is no longer considered the top threat by the leaders of the U.S. defense establishment. How did it get downgraded?
It got downgraded because of the recognition that our view of geopolitical threats was skewed somewhat by the horrific events of 9/11. I mean, we saw, 3,000 people perish in a single day. That was on par with the number, roughly, that had died at Pearl Harbor in another attack that we had not seen coming. But over the passage of time, with the fact that we've not had another 9/11 style attack, which in the past, fortunately, in the ensuing years, which nobody would have bet on September 12th, 2001. I was with President Bush down in Florida on the day of the attack, and we all thought there would be more attacks within weeks. But over time, people have begun to get back to sort of re-register what are the fundamental threats to the United States. And as you alluded to in the introduction, if you go through the 2007 National Threat Assessment, which is a public document that the intelligence community gives each year to Congress and then backs it up with a lot of classified assessments underneath it, if you go into that and you go to read the cyber section, it won't take much of your time. There's no mention of cyber in the entire document.
I laugh now, because you've just come out with an entire book about what you think basically poses the most significant threat to the country today.
Well, it's not what I think poses the most interesting threat to the country today. That same national threat assessment for the past 4 or 5 years has gone from no cyber to ranking cyber as number one, ahead of terrorism, ahead of nuclear proliferation, ahead of chemical and biological attacks.
You know, it's striking that it even ranks ahead of nuclear attacks, because for so long, we were used to this idea that, you know, the worst thing that could happen is this idea of massive physical destruction. Of course, that possibility still exists, but planners are now working on scenarios about us being hit by a cyber attack. So can you just detail for us what those cyber attacks look like?
Well, you know, I think one of the big arguments I'm trying to make in this book is that we have led ourselves down the wrong road for a while by doing too many comparisons between cyber and nuclear, thinking that because we deterred nuclear attacks over the course of the Cold War and beyond, that the same techniques would help us deter cyber attacks. Thinking that because nuclear is obviously a huge, overwhelming attack with mass casualties, that cyber is in some ways more manageable. And in fact, the more people have gotten into this, the more they've discovered that almost everything they thought was a one-for-one comparison is wrong. The questions are all the same. How do you deter it? How do you respond to it? The answers are all different. And the reason for that is that cyber and nuclear are completely different kinds of weapons. Cyber weapons are not on an on-off switch the way nuclear weapons are. They're really on a thermostat. You can dial them up. You can dial them down. You can make it as big as unplugging the electric power grid from Dallas and Fort Worth out to Austin or Boston to Washington, or you can try subtle manipulation of data to see if you can affect the registration into voting systems, or you can try to go into records and, you know, change everybody's blood type in the military, or you can attempt to do the kinds of attacks that you referred to at Sony, which was basically a political attack, politically motivated attack to stop a movie from being released. The North Koreans were very upset about a truly bad movie called The Interview that envisioned the assassination of Kim Jong-un, the nation's leader.
So there's a full range of attacks that you describe, from the full-blown, they hit infrastructure and they're very obvious, taking down a power grid, to the more subtle manipulative forms of attacking and trying to control another player's information. Why are these cyber attacks hard to stop?
They're hard to stop because, unlike nuclear attacks and unlike most physical attacks, you frequently don't know where they're coming from, and they are adjusted to be just below that level that would prompt a military response. Look, there's a reason no one's done the cyber Pearl Harbor yet, the unplugging of the electric grid, because if you do that and you get caught at it, you could well get visited by the U.S. Air Force or by missiles or other kind of military response to a cyber attack. In fact, the new Nuclear Posture Review, which is an annual or every few years strategy document turned out by the Pentagon, for the first time this year, says that nuclear weapons could be used in response to a major non-nuclear attack on infrastructure. They clearly meant a cyber attack. But the fact of the matter is, most of the time, it takes months to figure out where a cyber attack's really coming from. And most of the time, it's adjusted to a level that you would not, in a world of proportionate response, go blow up somebody's city because a cyber attack was launched. And you may not know whether that attack was launched by the government or by some patriotic hackers or by a terrorist group or by some criminals or just by some teenagers. So it's a much harder thing to respond to, and that has allowed a lot of states to fly in under the radar. And that's why we've seen so many more attacks. You know, in just 6 years ago, I wrote a book called Confront and Conceal that described for the first time in detail the American cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program, a program called Olympic Games. The virus was called Stuxnet. You may remember that from a few years ago. At the time I wrote that, we couldn't find another state-on-state attack that was truly sophisticated. When I was working on this book, stopped counting after 200 or so, and those are just the ones we know about.
Well, how do planners think that we would do as a country if we were under a sustained, comprehensive cyber attack? How would the American population respond?
Great question, because it depends on what is attacked. So obviously we were under a sustained attack during the election season, but it was done with a scalpel and people didn't really recognize its scope until after the election was over. And in the end, we don't think the Russians succeeded in actually manipulating votes. They may or may not have succeeded in manipulating minds. But a really interesting question would be, what would happen if the electric power system came down, and with it came down hospitals, communications, your ability to text to your family, to call anybody? And you have to assume at that moment you would get huge social disruption, perhaps even rioting, that the society and all of the divisions we've seen in it, and we've certainly seen many in the past few years, would get all the sharper, because it could well touch off a period of massive civil disturbance. And you could imagine an outside attacker thinking, why go attack the Americans when we can prompt them to attack each other?
Texas has its own power grid. Does that make it any safer?
Texas does have its own power grid, as do many other states in the union. It may be safer. It depends on how interdependent it is for backup on other states. And it also depends on how good the cyber protections inside this individual grid is. One of the things that helps the United States is that there is not one nationwide grid. So anybody who really wants to go have a cascading effect has got to get inside and learn about each of these different grids. So when you read that there is a Russian origin virus that the Department of Homeland Security has warned they have found in many power grids around the country, that makes sense, because anybody who is thinking in the future that they may want to, have to, or at least plan for attacking the power grid has to recognize that each one is as individual as your house. And just because I could affect the wiring in one house doesn't necessarily mean I could affect the wiring in another. So they have to be inside, patiently looking around to figure it out. And that's what good cyber attackers do. The North Korean hackers who went inside Sony got in September of 2014. They didn't attack until Thanksgiving. The United States and Israel spent months inside the Iranian system before they struck. The U.S. spent months inside the North Korean missile program before it attempted some strikes, which were of only mixed results, which I describe for the first time in this book.
What kinds of resources are we talking about here that the U.S. government is putting into building up its defenses?
Almost as much as they're putting into building up its offenses. There is a little bit of a mismatch, because offensive cyber is the responsibility of the government, and billions of dollars are being spent mostly in black budgets to build up major cyber offensive capability, not only on the covert side within the National Security Agency, but inside the Pentagon, where United States Cyber Command has built up now to 6,200 active cyber troops, and the whole command has been elevated to the same level as, say, U.S. Central Command, which handles our activity in the Middle East. But defense is a different issue, because most of the systems we need to defend, with the exception of government systems, are in private hands. And so the utilities, the financial markets, the most communication systems, they're all belonging to private enterprise. And the U.S. government can't simply go in and say, sorry, you can't operate unless you have cyber defenses up to a certain level, or at least so far that's been judged that's not the U.S. government's role. Now, at some point, there will be some minimum regulation. Cars were out on the road for a long time before people began requiring, or laws began requiring, airbags and then, you know, backup cameras and all the other safety devices. What's interesting is we're not in a position right now where the government is mandating similar safety minimums for things that you connect to the internet. And that's problematic, because while our cyber defenses have definitely improved in the past 5 years, the amount of target space has also increased dramatically, because we have internet-connected refrigerators and internet-connected cars and internet-connected radios.
David E. Sanger is our guest today. His latest book is titled The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. You're listening to Think on KERA. We'll be back after this short break. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Sanger. His new book is titled The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. David, you have a critical eye on the secrecy in which all of this activity is happening. Few Americans know about the planning involved for this kind of warfare, which has implications for policymaking. Why has there been so little in the way of public debate?
Well, it's a great question, because while it's clear that the government wants to keep much of what happens in the cyber world secret, I argue in the book that the secrecy is actually now becoming detrimental to our national security. Now, I realize that seems counterintuitive to some, but think about this for a moment. First of all, even in the nuclear age, while we kept secret how you build weapons and where we store them and who exactly has the authority to fire them, we had a rip-roaring open public debate about how and when we would use nuclear weapons. And it ended up in a completely different place than it started. You'll remember that back in the 1950s, MacArthur wanted to use nuclear weapons against the North Koreans and the Chinese. Eisenhower used to say that nuclear weapons were just another bullet in the arsenal. We don't think he really believed it, but he said it. And we ended up in the 1980s, after much national debate and soul searching, saying, you know, we're only going to use nuclear weapons as a matter of national survival. Now, fast forward to cyber. Because we have not had a single critical incident like Hiroshima and Nagasaki that seared into the minds of people around the world how powerful the weapon was, the government has basically gotten away with not discussing its capabilities and saying any discussion of capabilities would help the Chinese or the Russians or the North Koreans or the Iranians. And it might some, but most sophisticated cyber players know what we can do. And anybody who spent time going through the Snowden leaks certainly knows, has a pretty good idea of where the programs were at least 5 or 6 years ago, and they can extrapolate out from that. The problem with oversecrecy is threefold. First, you can't really explain the threat to Americans. Second, you can't really explain what things you are willing to put off limits so that other countries might also put them off limits. So, Kim, if you and I sat down and we thought to ourselves, okay, what are some things we agree countries should not attack using cyber weapons against their adversaries? So hospitals, mm-hmm. That's a really easy one, okay? Voting systems, we might say nobody should be messing around in the voting systems of another nation. Communications, particularly emergency communication systems. Nursery schools. I mean, I bet if we just sat down over lunch, we'd probably come up with a list of 20 things, right?
Sure.
If you then took that list to the American intelligence community and said, we want to go negotiate a sort of digital Geneva Convention, an idea that some people, including Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, and some leaders at Siemens and others have been arguing for. I think the intelligence community would say, what? We're going to give up forever the ability to influence elections? Remember, we had to do that in Italy and Japan in the 40s and Iran in the 50s and Latin America throughout the 60s. I'm not sure we want to give that up. And then the U.S. Cyber Command might roll in and say, well, you know, we had a program to bring down all of Iran without firing a shot if things go bad with Iran. It was called Nitro Zeus. It's described at length in The Perfect Weapon. And it basically would have unplugged the country, which also means unplugging those nursing homes and hospitals. So they might say, I'm not sure we want to sign up to that either. So the secrecy in part is to keep a debate from breaking out about what we're willing to give up as well as what we're willing to do.
Well, aren't lawmakers supposed to have some level of civilian oversight around these decisions and the way things are proceeding?
They are, and they do. They certainly have regular hearings, both public and non-public, with U.S. Cyber Command, with the NSA. But a couple of things have happened. First of all, the NSA will say almost nothing, and Cyber Command as well, in those public hearings. The ability of members of Congress to understand the technology here varies greatly. I know some members of those oversight committees who are very sophisticated and can talk to you at a pretty high end about cyber. And I know some who think it's cute to say, well, you know, I don't even really use a computer. I can check with my grandchildren and so forth. Would you say that if you were responsible for the oversight of nuclear weapons? Would it be charming to voters to say, I don't really know very much about it, and try to be, you know, just sort of revel in your ignorance? Probably not. But because it's computers and people like to say, oh, I don't really get it, and it seems to be kind of humble, and some are genuinely in a fog, and there are many things in the computer world I can't go off and do, they think that's an acceptable answer. At a moment when this is judged the number one threat by the intelligence community to the United States, I don't think that answer is quite as cute as it used to be.
Through your book, you mentioned conversations you've had with defense officials, folks in different agencies working on these issues and have been for quite some time. And there does seem to be a theme that comes forward, which seems to be there have been a lot of wake-up calls, but no one is quite yet fully, completely woken up. Do you think there needs to be some kind of, well, maybe I'm thinking about the 2016 presidential elections and the role that Russia ultimately played. Was that a wake-up call of sorts?
Well, it should have been. And, you know, there's a moment in the book where Sue Gordon, who is now the deputy director of national intelligence, is at a conference and we're sitting having dinner. And she says to me at one point, David, was the Russia hack our cyber Pearl Harbor, you know, the big wake-up moment that grabbed the country's attention? And my answer to that is, if you have to ask, it probably wasn't, because we all knew at the moment of Pearl Harbor. I wasn't around for it, but my dad was in college at the time and was in the Navy within days, that Pearl Harbor was a great turning point, the way 9/11 was a great turning point in American history. We have not had that moment in cyber. And I would argue that the 2016 election hack was designed by Vladimir Putin to be short of something that would cause a great reaction. In fact, that's what part of what makes this the perfect weapon, that you can so calibrate it that you can try to anticipate how your adversary country will or will not begin to react.
And you write that was far from the first time Russia meddled with U.S. networks and information. What is their strategy towards us?
Well, their strategy seems to be one of disruption. You know, we went through a period of time after the fall of the Berlin Wall and during President Clinton's meetings with Yeltsin and then early in the Bush administration, where it seemed like Russia was genuinely interested in seeing if it could join Europe and become part of the West. But at some moment, we've seen Vladimir Putin make the decision that his better bet is as the great disruptor, not to be a member, but to be outside. He doesn't think that he can restore the full glory of the former Soviet Union, but he certainly has said publicly on more than one occasion that the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union. I'm not sure most Americans would necessarily sign up to that same belief. I'm not even sure most Russians would sign up to that, but it plays to a certain nationalism within the country. For him, cyber is exactly the kind of weapon that he needs. It's cheap. And if you're broke, cheap is good. It's stealthy. You can cause a lot of disruption, but not actually prompt the United States to threaten nuclear war. And in the case of the 2016 election, our additional problem was that it so played to the internal divisions within the country that you couldn't even get consensus from the President of the United States about whether it happened. I mean, you could imagine a moment in which the President would have been inaugurated on January 20th, 2017, and then sit down and say, "My fellow Americans, I was legitimately elected. I have no reason to believe the Russians had any particular effect, but we've certainly seen evidence that they were trying, and we can't let that happen in our country, and I'm creating a 9/11 type commission to learn all the lessons from our mistakes and make sure we never make them again in the 2018 congressional elections or in the 2020 presidential election." Instead, President Trump decided to form a commission that would look at the 3 million votes that he thought should have gone to him, but were fraudulently taken away. That commission, of course, collapsed of its own weight without ever reporting out. But we lost a big moment, and we've just lost another one in this White House. And we'll get back to this because I'm more critical in this book of the Obama administration than I am of the Trump administration. But at a moment that we're facing all these threats, John Bolton, the new National Security Advisor, just eliminated the post of cybersecurity coordinator in the White House, something that had been in the Obama administration and in the first years of the Trump administration, and didn't just get rid of the occupants of the job, but eliminated the job at a moment that even the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security aren't quite certain who's responsible for defending what.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. Well, David, the intelligence community did conclude that Russians had indeed attempted to influence the presidential election in 2016, and it was quite the image seeing all the heads of the various intelligence agencies testifying in Congress in agreement, even as the newly elected President Trump disagreed. We have not responded to that hacking. How does Russia interpret our lack of response?
Well, to give credit to the Trump administration, there was some response from both the end of the Obama administration and the first year of the Trump administration. President Obama threw 35 diplomats that were actually spies out of the country and closed two Russian facilities, one of which I learned in the course of the reporting for this book, the Russians were using to dig deep underground and get in at one of our big trunk cables. That expulsion of diplomats was, as someone high up in the Obama administration said to me, and I quote in the book, the perfect 19th century response to a 21st century problem, right? Mm. The Trump administration has, in fact, done some more expulsions, closed some more facilities. So even while President Trump has cast doubt about this, the Treasury Department, the intelligence agencies, they've all continued to act, not super aggressively, but they have acted. What was more surprising in the course of my reporting was how little we had responded to those earlier hacks by the Russians. They went into the White House unclassified email system. They went into the State Department, took months to get them out of that. They battled the NSA when the NSA tried to rouse them from the White House positions, just to show that they could battle the NSA. They went into the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These were all prior to the DNC hack, and the Obama administration did not make public what was going on, although some of us were writing about it. It was pretty clear who was doing it, and they certainly didn't punish the Russians for it. So if you're Vladimir Putin, you're thinking, well, if they won't defend the White House, who's going to care about the Democratic National Committee, which is essentially staffed by college kids?
You are critical of the Obama administration's response in different scenarios to different attacks. What do they tell you now that they're out of office, about what was behind their approach?
Caution and fear of an escalatory string that they could not control. So once it was clear that Putin was behind the election hack, and it took a year for the White House to sort of recognize the depth of that. It was the summer of 2016. There were all these interesting proposals floating around the White House to cut off Putin from the world financial system, expose his ill-gotten gains and his connections to the oligarchs, all kinds of penalties people had in mind. And President Obama said, look, if we do those, we may feel good for a bit, but he could come back on election day and begin to manipulate votes, registrations. Remember, this is the time that they're seeing the Russians trying to get inside the registration systems in Arizona and Illinois, trying to siphon off data, and they feared trying to change data. So the president decided that he would just wait until after the election. And since there was an unspoken assumption that Hillary Clinton would win, the idea was they'd develop a plan to go deal with the Russians, and President Clinton, when she took office, would just accelerate that. Well, it didn't quite work out that way.
We are heading into midterm elections this fall. What kinds of questions do you have about how secure our election systems are?
Well, one of the first striking things about our election system in 2016 is that the system itself, or the systems themselves, because every state is different, were not considered part of the critical infrastructure that we protect against cyber. The utilities are, the cell phone network is, national monuments are considered critical infrastructure in the United States, but not the underpinning of our democracy. And when the director or the Secretary of Homeland Security at the time, Jay Johnson, attempted to get the election systems designated part of the critical infrastructure of the United States, secretaries of state in many states objected, saying you're trying to take over the entire election system. You're trying to federalize it. This is a state function. Well, I don't think he was trying to do that, but he was concerned that some states were wide open and others had put in pretty good protections, and we needed to have an assessment of how good those were. My own view for Election Day is there is no excuse for any state not to have a paper backup to your ballot, so that sooner or later you can sort out how the voting went, even if somebody is messing with the electrons.
David E. Sanger is our guest today. His new book is titled The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. You're listening to Think here on KERA in Dallas. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. My guest today, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Sanger. His new book is titled The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. David, let's take a look now at individuals who are taking in information, using it, living their lives digitally online. We had a lot of conversation about where people were getting their information from in the lead up to the election, and more particularly the role that Facebook had to play. What are the most important questions now in your mind for social media platforms like Facebook going forward?
Well, we are caught in a sort of digital conundrum because on the one hand, if you want to make sure in a perfect world that platforms like Facebook, and not just Facebook, but Twitter as well and other social media, are not used by foreigners to influence an American election, then you have to have pretty perfect knowledge about who's posting what. But we also live in a world of free speech, or at least a nation that cherishes free speech. We don't want to establish rules that enables Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and President Erdogan in Turkey and others to demand the same kind of perfect understanding of who's on the web, who's communicating, who's doing what, and then use it to perpetuate the great crackdowns that you've seen in the past few years. And this is really the great irony of the internet age. We thought it would spread liberty. And in fact, it has become the favorite tool of authoritarians.
Well, for people who are wondering what steps I can take to protect myself, my family, my workplace safer, what can you tell them?
Look, there are some basic cyber hygiene things that there are, you know, other books that have been written about, lots of videos on, lots of YouTube on, all of which you should do to protect yourself as well as you can. You know, two-factor authentication, which means you go into, say, your banking site, it comes back and sends a code to your cell phone to make sure you are who it thinks you are, or you have a token or some other way of authenticating your identity quietly. That is all very useful stuff to do. They're not 100%. If you're in a country where the state owns the telecoms provider, then the state will also see that six-digit code you get where you're supposed to prove that you're you, right? So there are all kinds of ways around this. All those things are good to do. They will take care of most of the vandals, the criminals, the teenagers, the low-end hackers. But there's not a whole lot you're going to do if a state decides to come muck in the American systems and networks. They're probably not going to worry about you and me, but there's not much you can do to stop them, just as you can put in locks and alarm systems in your house, but it's not going to stop a nuclear missile. It's just not designed to go do that. So part of the argument of this book is that we not only need physical solutions to this problem, technological solutions to this problem. We need to do that to clean out the sort of low-hanging fruit that is most of the cyber crime we see. But we need political solutions that begin to address what states are and are not willing to go do to each other. And will that be perfect? Absolutely not. People violate the Geneva Conventions all the time. The Syrians drop gas on their own people. But it would begin to establish some norms. And every time we've tried that, so far it's failed.
David, I'm wondering to what extent the potency of these weapons, cyber weapons, that they depend on how panicked or how unquestioning the public is willing to be. For instance, you know, some argue that if you change your life and stop doing activities that you enjoy because you fear a terrorist attack, well, then terrorism wins. Is that an apt analogy here for people living in this world of cyber warfare?
It's not bad, Kim, because the cyber equivalent of this is that you move to Montana and go into a log cabin and have no internet, no cable, no cell phone,
right,
and sit there and read books by candlelight.
Sounds okay? Good to me, David.
And, you know, as the summer approaches, that's got a particular appeal to me. Particularly after, book tour and things like that, particularly if you spent your time discussing this topic. But let's face it, that is not a solution for our society. If anything, we are going to become more and more and more connected over the next 20 or 25 years, right? You're seeing it happen every day. It's no coincidence that 2007 National Intelligence Report that failed to mention cyber, that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, came out a few weeks before the iPhone. And the iPhone has done more to put connectivity in our pocket to the point that the phone is the least interesting part of the entire device. You're using it for texting, you're using it for computing, you're using it to read your stuff, you're using it to order things over Amazon and get your medical records moved and all that. So the phone's the least of it. We're going to become more and more connected. So we're not going to eliminate this risk, but we are going to manage this risk, which takes me back to why I think it's so dangerous that the government has put so much secrecy around both our vulnerabilities and around our capabilities.
From where, if any place, do you see pressure building for the government to become more open about this topic?
You know, there hasn't been a huge amount of pressure. There has been pressure between government and industry about how much information they will share with each other. But there isn't much of a public understanding. And it's one of the reasons I went out to go write The Perfect Weapon, that you and I are the collateral damage in a battle that's taking place sort of 30,000 feet above our heads among states. Not always. Sometimes people are just trying to go steal your credit cards. But go back to the hack that you mentioned at the very opening of the show, the Office of Personnel Management, which lost about 22 million security records. These aren't just Social Security numbers and birth dates. These are the forms that people who are trying to get security clearances fill out. And it's all their relationships and all their medical background and so forth. The Chinese government took all of this stuff. And the U.S. government's response was to send people out a note saying, we're giving you free credit protection for the next year or two. Well, that was ridiculous. There has never been that we've seen a serious case of leakage of this information by people who want to steal your credit cards. This is being taken by states that want to put together an image, a picture of who's worked with whom on the most sensitive issues in the U.S. government. And we're still pretending to people like we think it's criminal activity related to stealing your credit card numbers.
Through the book, you point to the people's not having the true wake-up call, of not understanding the full scope of the problem. And you also point to what you suggest is that the U.S. actually needs a strategy for this. What would be a good strategy that you would advocate for?
Well, here's one area where nuclear analogies do work, because when we came through that period of the 40s and 50s after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, technologists, strategists, social scientists sat down and said, we need to come up with some strategies to survive the Cold War. And we did. We came up with mutually assured destruction. Henry Kissinger wrote a fascinating book that I reread before I wrote this called Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy that sought to go look at exactly those kinds of issues. In the digital world, we need to figure out what's the individual's responsibility to protect, what of our own information, what's our bankers, our cell phone providers, our cable providers' responsibility to protect, and what's our government's responsibility to protect. And then we have to go the next step and say, okay, if we think that it's off limits for people to go muck in our elections, what kind of global rules do we want to begin advocating for so that nobody mucks in anyone's elections, including us? And that's where we're having a hard time with the U.S. government, because naturally no government wants to give up its options.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Kim Malcolm, in for Chris Boyd. Well, when it comes to our understanding of our vulnerability in this digital age, some folks have a certain fatalistic attitude about it. You know, it's too late. My data's already out there, so I just can't worry about it. Other folks, though, are trying to encrypt whatever they can. Where do you fall in that range when it comes to figuring out how concerned or how worried you should be?
You know, I come out where a presidential commission of intelligence officials, Republicans, Democrats, appointed by President Obama after the Snowden leaks came out, which is, I believe it should be the policy of the U.S. government that encryption should become standard, that we don't want our medical records, our banking records, our cell phone chats, our iMessages. You don't want those to be in an unencrypted world in which everything can go leak out. We care about our privacy. Now, people then say, look, we need to balance that with security, and the government has to have the right to come in the way they can come into your door and take your paper documents and figure out if you've committed a crime. And I'm sympathetic with that. But the problem in the high-tech world is, if you bore a hole in the Apple iPhone that allows the FBI to get in with a warrant, you've also bored a hole that will allow the Chinese and the Russians to get in without one. And people always think there's a balancing act here, and to some degree, and sometimes there are. But there are some technological cases where I think we're just going to have to absorb the price that encryption's going to mean that there's some things the government's not going to be able to go find out about you. And I recognize why that's disturbing to the FBI, to police, they will come up with very legitimate cases where they say, you know, someone's been kidnapped and we have a short period of time to go find them. We need to be able to get through to the encryption and through the encryption and compel that kind of disclosure. But the fact of the matter is, if somebody had written things in a coded language that you couldn't get at, you'd have sort of the same issue. So I'm beginning to think that the government's arguments in favor of the need to be able to see everything, even with a warrant, is going to in some ways make us more vulnerable to foreign powers.
David, you worked on this book for a few years, and I'm wondering, what are the biggest questions you would still like to pursue?
Well, there are a number of big ones. One of the biggest is, how does artificial intelligence fit into this picture? Because you could imagine a situation in which as artificial intelligence becomes more and more predominant, we end up automating and speeding up a lot of the processes that right now you can have good judgment step in. Let me give you an example. Back in the 1970s, Bill Perry, who was later defense secretary, but at that time was a political appointee in the Defense Department, got woken up one night by a watch officer who said, "Sir, I think we've got this under control, but we're seeing 170 nuclear missiles headed toward the United States from the Soviet Union." It was at a time of no particular tensions. And of course, everybody immediately thought this could be a mistake. But do you wake up the president? Do you get him to respond just in case it wasn't a mistake and it was a decapitating strike? And they fairly quickly figured out that a training tape had been put in the real operating system and it was faking an attack on the United States of 170 nuclear missiles. So what's the cyber equivalent of that? You've got computers that are looking to be that early warning system and trying to respond in digital time, which means milliseconds. And you take out the time for judgment and you take out the moment to say, this doesn't look right, this doesn't smell right. And that worries me because you could imagine how destabilizing that could be. Once you can begin to alter somebody's voice or picture, you could make a president or a presidential candidate appear to say anything you wanted. Once you were able to get inside a database and alter the blood types of members of the military, you could cause great havoc on the battlefield. So we need to begin to think about whether the new technologies we're working on are actually going to close down our ability to fight back at this a little bit and take a little time. We're not going to eliminate digital technologies. We don't want to. We all live by them. We would never give them up. But we want to feel as if we're in control of them.
David Sanger, thank you very much for this.
Thank you, Kim. Great to be with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts was our engineer today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Kim Malcolm in for Chris Boyd. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.